Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Maybe we could just jump right into it. Could you walk me through the sequence of events here? How did this happen?
What is the first part of the game, I believe? And always extra special when I get to play in Seattle in front of my family, get a little hyped up.
Johnny Hecker grew up in Bothell, but when he took the field in Seattle in 2015, it was against the Seahawks. At the time, he was a St. Louis Ram, L.A. Ram now. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and what Hecker did next made him infamous here in the Northwest.
It was just running down after I punted the ball, saw a body there, and decided to give him a little nudge. And, man, did not anticipate him going to the ground like that. Just caught him right at the right moment. You know, he's a big guy.
Personal foul, unnecessary roughness, number six.
And then as soon as he hit the ground, I thought, man, oh, no.
When did it dawn on you who you had just given a shove to?
Right after he got back up, yeah, I saw it was Cliff Averill.
We see him take a shot here, Cliff Averill. I don't know if you want to go around doing that to that guy.
I wasn't trying to be tough or anything. I was just, you know, giving a guy a nudge, like a little running down the field. And
let's unpack the dynamic a little bit for people who might be like a Fairweather fan.
Okay.
So you are a big guy, but punters are not sort of stereotypically giants.
Right.
But Cliff Averill is.
Right. Big man. So we're actually not too far off. Size might be a little bit taller, but he's definitely got me in some muscle poundage.
But he's also kind of a trained killer. Right?
Yes, I mean,
he's a pass rusher. He is he's out there to level people.
Yes.
And you're typically not having a lot of contact.
More of a finesse player, yeah. You know, it was a dumb play, and of course now I got four of the biggest guys on their team all mad at me trying to rip my head off, so I knew it was a kind of going like self preservation mode. It wasn't the most bright idea I've ever had in my life, I'll tell you that.
And how did the self preservation mode play out?
Michael Bennett is a charging bull, and I am a matador in a sense, just trying to not, you know, get gored out there in front of thousands. And,
so he takes a run at you on your next punt.
Yeah, he did, and I wasn't really having that. I punted the ball and shied away from contact, some would say.
He's going to avoid any kind of penalty. They saw what he did last time. Look, they want revenge.
I hate to needle you on it, but I describe physically how you evaded that maneuver. Like, what was your evasive maneuver?
There was a bit of going to the ground,
and
using
maybe
the hands and shoulder,
protecting your vital organs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I already have a helmet protecting my head, so just curling up, kind of protecting the rest of the body, and not leave myself open to attack. Yeah.
And how did Averill and some of his teammates react? And did that change, like, in the heat of the moment versus a little later?
Of course, the heat of the moment, they were all very, very upset. But, you know, as time went on, they realized, you know, it's part of the game. We'll just let him live. You know, I got a lot of flack on the internet and all over. So it was the kind of thing where I think they realized that I had done more damage to myself than they could probably do. So it's just crazy because that kind of stuff happens. Then you have little third graders calling you all sorts of cuss words on the internet and saying you're a wuss. And you're like, wow.
So when all said and done, do you regret doing it?
Do I regret doing it? That's a difficult question. There's yes and no. You know, that's how I play. I'm shouldn't really apologize for being an aggressive player and just building identity of being a tough guy, I guess.
Well, you're also a really good sport to come in and talk to us about it.
Thank you so much. Yeah. No hiding here. I'm excited. I'm in the area, so just to get to kind of clear my name a little bit. City of Seattle, please, you can love me now. Please.
Bothell native Johnny Hecker, now a punter for the LA Rams. I found him a total delight to talk to. I guess just because he seems so open and warm and self-deprecating. And you know what? Today, I don't need any more reason than that to share a story with you because, dang it, today is the Gabriel Show. This month, the Sound Effect team has been taking turns rounding up personal favorite stories that we've worked on. We've heard our show now through the ears of producers Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. And now, it's my turn. Okay, so I want you to listen to something. This is the sound when a balloon pops. Okay, so here is what it sounds like if a balloon were to pop inside of an empty 2-million-gallon water tank at Fort Worden State Park in Port Townsend. Now, that is what you call reverb. In fact, it's still going and going and will keep going for another 30 seconds or so. The guy behind that sound is named Stuart Dempster, and he is a pretty well-known composer and trombonist. He's an emeritus professor at the University of Washington these days, and he's had a long interest in recording music out in unusual places. So when he learned about this empty cistern, he thought, hey, maybe this could be a venue for one heck of an acoustic set, the ultimate unplugged album.
Composer David Mahler, who used to live in Seattle, he now lives in Pittsburgh, had told me about it, and he'd been in it. And when we went to do a workshop there together in 1978, they had decided, well, we can't have people in there. They had cemented it off. So I spent the next 12 years badgering Dan Harpel, for whom the cistern is named, to see if he could help in getting it open. And help he did. And eventually got permissions for people to do work in there. It's sort of like being in a wine cellar without any of the accoutrements. It was cold, damp, and if you set down anything for a little while, it picks up moisture, and you know, paper would become sort of not soggy exactly, but you knew there was a lot of moisture in there. All the walls were dripping. I figured that teenagers and other folks were probably partying in there and throwing beer bottles around and just to listen to the sound and the shattering glass. If you're going to build a chord in the cistern, which has a 45-second reverberation, which is quite amazing, you can build a chord up in any reverberation length by your first note being the loudest and longest and the second one being successively a little bit softer, a little bit shorter, and you can get several note chords. You play a note, and you can release it in such a way, if you do it just right, you can sort of play it and it crescendos a little bit, and then you diminuendo just slightly to leave the sound, but the cistern will continue crescendoing the note for a little bit. So you really can't tell when the cistern takes over. Old metal pieces that I can't imagine where a lot of that would have come from. We use the metal, and it's pretty fun hearing all that stuff reverberated.
What makes it artistically interesting for you and not just a kind of quirk or parlor trick?
You can set up all kinds of harmonies, of course, I think, but probably the main thing is that you feel like you have all this support. It's like a support of a really engaged audience. Something is supporting you, and of course it's your own sound. Sort of like drowning in whipped cream. It was rather a pleasant drowning. Drowning in sound is really something special.
Like it's almost being, you're almost flooded or overwhelmed, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it's ambisonic to a degree that it's almost hard to fathom. I'd like to think of it as spherical because you're just getting sound from all over, and you sometimes lose track of what's you and what's the reverberation of you, and it's very, very special. It's really listening and deciding, well, this pitch will work really well here. You can't do a lot of stuff because then it turns into sonic granola pretty quickly. After about 3 days of practicing there, I came out and I realized that I had adjusted to the cistern as being the norm, and the rest of the world was seemed more alien than I was expecting.
So what has working in the cistern taught you about listening?
I suppose the most important thing it taught me and the most unusual thing is it taught me to listen to the end of the sound. Most people lose interest when there's still about 15 or 20 seconds of reverberation to listen to. Maybe it's only kind of a pulse that you feel maybe almost more than hear.
Where does the cistern work fall for you? What does it mean to you now, looking back on a long career?
If I had my druthers, I'd probably do nothing else.
Really?
Yeah, but yeah, it's just because it's such a... I'm somewhat into healing music as a restorative. I mean, there's many world cultures, there's no separation of art and life, or music and healing, as it were. It can breathe easier. It lowers my blood pressure, I guess. It's comforting. So anyway, I really like being in that restorative music space.
Stuart Dempster is a composer and an emeritus professor at the University of Washington. So, do me a favor, picture Sasquatch. For me, it's a very specific image. It's a big, hairy humanoid, mid-stride, arms swinging, head turned to glance back over its right shoulder. It's an iconic picture, and the thing that Bigfoot was turning back to look at was Bob Gimlin. Gimlin, along with Roger Patterson, gathered their famous film footage in Northern California in 1967. 50 years later, people still pore over it, debating its authenticity and speculating on how it might have been faked. Well, that film, which launched 1,000 Bigfoot hunters, also ruined Bob's life. Bob Gimlin lives in Yakima. He's a man of many interests, it's just that most of them have to do with horses.
Say, oh, this is the old stud horse. He's an old-timer. Step on outside. Step out.
We are at a friend's farm in Yakima, where Bob keeps most of his horses. He's spent decades making his living around animals.
This old sleigh here, I'd hook Kilargo, that stallion, when he was young, to this sleigh and give the kids rides in here.
Bob is a real-deal cowboy. He used to break horses, he rode in an honest-to-God sheriff's posse, and of course, he rode in rodeos. When he was young, at least. He's 86 now.
I quit rodeoing altogether in 1958 and enjoyed rodeo, and that's where I met Roger Patterson at the rodeos.
Bob and Roger hit it off, but then after Bob quit the circuit, they didn't see each other for a few years, until one day in 1961.
I stopped at my uncle's service station down in Union Gap, and the guy walked out, and it was Roger.
As they caught up, Roger told Bob he wanted to show him something. He came back with a large plaster cast of a footprint, a big footprint. Well, Bob wasn't sure what to make of that, but he was open-minded enough that one day later, when Roger came knocking, he was willing to listen.
So he come running into my place, and he said, Bob, can you take me to Northern California? And I said, well, can't do it now. He said, Labor Day weekend, they found all these tracks down there after they come back to work.
Bob agreed to load up 3 horses in his trailer and head down to the area around Willow Creek in Northern California. The 2 men mounted up and headed deep into the woods on old logging roads.
The leaves were all changing, reds and yellows, and it was pretty rugged, you know, it was hills like that. We were just riding up there, and Roger was taking pictures of me on the horse and leading the pack horse. That's when Roger's horse started just the jumping and the lunging. And I could see that there's something going on there. I look over there and there's a Bigfoot standing just on the other side of the creek from us. But he just immediately turned, started walking away. Well, Roger by then had got his camera out of the saddlebag on his horse, and he was up running across the creek there. He hit the other side of the bank and stumbled and kind of fell down on his elbows. And that's when it made that famous head turn. It's when I stepped down off the horse. My mind thought, well, yeah, these things really do exist after all this I heard about them and stuff. And I've been wanting to see a track. Here's one walking right away from me, right in front of me here.
There was no doubt in Bob's mind. This was no hoax. This was Bigfoot. Once they'd calmed their horses down, they tried to follow her. She appeared to be a rather heavy-bosomed female, but to no avail.
And then we talked about the smell and different things and musky, skunky smell. And Roger said, oh, it smelled like an old dog that rolled in cow. And I said, well, yeah, maybe that.
Once the shaky footage was developed, Roger was giddy. He was sure he had a gold mine on his hands. But Bob was not so impressed.
When I first saw the film, I thought, oh, that ain't nothing. I said, I saw a lot more than that. So I was kind of the bad guy.
So that was the first crack in their friendship. They hit the road with the film, trying to interest investors and maybe sell the story to Hollywood. But Bob says his heart wasn't in it. He had horses to take care of.
You know, there was a lot of disagreement right from the get-go. I said, I got to go back to work to make a living.
Still, Roger and his associates continued the roadshow with one major difference.
They hired some guy that said he was me.
So, touring the country, making money with a Bob Gimlin impersonator.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that was it for Bob and Roger. Bob says the two never spoke again. That is, until Roger was on his deathbed.
His brothers called me and said, Bob, he's asked to see you. So I went to see a little old dried-up guy there in a bed, and he rallied up a little bit and said, Bob, oh, man, it's so good to see you. And I said, yeah, Rog. Bobby said, I apologize. And I said, well, why did you hire a guy and he saves me? Well, he said, we had to do something to get people to come in. And I said, well, dadgummit, Roger. He said, Bob, he said, I've got the money and the means and stuff now and the equipment. He said, as quick as I get well, you and I are going to go back down there to California and capture Bigfoot. Well, that was in the afternoon, and he was dead the next morning.
Bob says he forgave Roger at that point. But still, he seethed that this had turned into a payday for others, but not for him.
My wife said, let's just get away from it, Bob. You went through so much over that, and it's bothered you a lot and made a different person out of you.
What did she mean by that, that it's made a different person out of you?
Well, I was a person that never held grudges against anybody. Now, once you're thinking about hurting somebody.
And Bob chafed at the mockery, the constant mockery that seemed to follow him wherever he went. When the ridicule reached his wife at her bank job, that was the breaking point.
They razzed her about it in where she was working, and she'd come home bawling and saying, oh, God, Bob, I wish you'd have never went down there with Roger. And I said, I do too.
So Bob disowned Bigfoot. He stopped doing interviews and answering mail about it.
I used to get really upset, but kept saying, I keep my temper, trying to just stay away from it for that 35 years until Dimitri said, I'm coming to the United States to have some time with you. Dimitri Baranov, a Russian scientist, one of the top Russian scientists, he said, well, if Bob can't make it to Russia, I'll come to the United States to have some time with him.
Bayanov has written about Sasquatch, as well as its counterpart, what they call the Russian snowman. He came to the U.S. to attend a conference in California, and he convinced Bob Gimlin to go along with him. Reluctantly, Bob agreed to give a talk.
And that's about all I can tell you about that short film footage of what happened.
He didn't know what to expect. For decades, his story had gotten nothing but ridicule.
It's still in my mind real clear, but when I see it, it's probably going to be a different story.
It was like lifting a weight off my shoulders. Here's all these people just anxious to hear what went on and believed in me. And when I walked in the room, standing ovation. And I thought, now wait a minute. How did this turn around in a few days?
Not only was he accepted by this group of believers, he was revered. He was a rock star. He started going to Bigfoot conferences again, giving interviews again, signing autographs. But not everyone in Bob's life was on board, which partially explains why he and I are talking inside of a Jeep parked at his friend's farm and not at his place.
My wife allows it, but she will not go to any of them with me because of the bad days that she had. She just says, I won't allow anybody that has anything to do with it to come to my place and do any filming or any interviews. You do what you want to, but I'm not going to go do any of it.
And that's sort of the agreement that Bob made with the world, too. He knows what he saw, and if you don't believe him, fine. You're the sucker.
I strongly believe if a real one walked in the house and sat down at a table, or the best it could, and they'd say, no, it's a fake, somebody in a suit. That's how naive they are. So that's just the way I'd tell them till the day they spank me in the face with dirt, you know.
Bob Gimlin lives in Yakima. The Seattle band Culture Shock lives up to its name. They weave together Eastern European folk music with strains of metal and so-called gypsy punk. The new song Taiyu is sung all in Japanese. Culture Shock's songs promote justice and rail against fascism. Lead singer Gino Yevgevic is a burly, tattooed fellow with a shaved head, beard down to his chest, and streaked with gray. Gino's passion for art, his compulsion to create, is what eventually pulled him out of the war zone his hometown of Sarajevo had become. In 1992, Yugoslavia was busy tearing itself to pieces. The country was breaking up along religious lines, leading to a long and bloody war. But before everything descended into chaos, Gino was living the dream. He was a clean-shaven, suit-and-tie-wearing, ponytail-sporting pop star. The name of his group? Gino Banana.
Gino Banana.
We became pretty recognized. I hate the word famous and celebrity, so I don't even know how to say that. Yeah, we were like, whatever.
Did you get recognized in the street?
Yeah.
Did you sign autographs?
Yeah.
Did people want to pose for pictures with you?
Yeah, no, there was no selfies, though. Selfies did not exist. It was great. And you know what? I have to say, like, people, oh, it's horrible burden. No, it wasn't. It was great. I loved it. Especially when you're a kid. It's amazing, and, you know, but then you overgrow it. Then you overgrow it. And then maybe something like war happens to, you know, to remind you, hey, you know. I don't know what would have happened. I mean, I probably would become one of those guys at the record label, you know.
If not for the war, you mean?
If not for the war, right. you know, I envy you, actually. You guys go to war and you come back from the war. We don't go to war. War comes to us. Sitting home, minding your own business. Psh, boom.
For more than 2 months now, Sarajevo has been under siege.
Then we were trapped in the city. It's amazing. So we were in a war, and you all of a sudden you can't get out, and you have a bunch of record-selling musicians in the town doing nothing.
So once the reality kind of set in of being locked down where you were, of the war being, you know, surrounding mm-hmm. Sarajevo, how did you cope? Like, where did you direct your energies?
I actually recommended my friends and these directors and choreographers and a bunch of actors. We were all in one theater, and I gave an idea to do musical Hair. I remember everybody saying, "Are you crazy, man? Anti-war musical in a war-torn country?" Like, yeah, but let's twist it out. Who cares? Let's play for ourselves. We did whole musical.
Was it one performance or a series of them?
It was about 300 performances.
Oh my gosh. So were you doing it like every day?
Every single day. At 1 o'clock p.m. because we had a curfew at 9.
And did people show up?
Packed every single time. We never had one place. And we ran it for 3 years. We got devastated. Our sound guy died like first year. My guitar player and co-writer, he got injured. By going to the theater, he's alive still. Yeah, people took out of shrapnel out of his head. We redid the play again and running it until the point where we couldn't do it anymore.
Why was it worth risking your life to go make that show?
Selfish. Ness is allowed in art. Art might be one and only activity of a human that can allow selfishness as a positive category. That means that you're creating what comes to you, that the creation is a purpose to itself. That's, I think, what was driving us.
At the performances, UN officials and American celebrities sat shoulder to shoulder with the trapped residents of Sarajevo. The production also happened to catch the attention of Phil Alden Robinson, the man who wrote and directed the movie Field of Dreams. What had seemed like an insane idea just a few years before, putting on an anti-war musical in a war zone, ended up being Gino's ticket out of Sarajevo. Phil Alden Robinson got visas for Gino and some of the other cast members of Hair and brought them to the United States. He wanted to make a movie about this unlikely theater troupe.
Phil could not put the movie together because probably it wasn't very attractive to, I guess, you know, it wasn't very attractive to Hollywood. There was no Steven Seagal saving Blonde from the barbarians, you know, that don't know anything else but fighting each other. You know, we were portrayed like a people, which, you know, it's not sellable, I guess. And that kind of confirmed my stand about alternative music and alternative art, and never to go to the commercial world again. And then, you know, the only thing that we did, we came to Seattle and made the theater about the theater play. That was, you know, the second prize.
And so you created the play Behind God's Back, yeah, which was a play about the production of Hair.
Yeah.
And what was that like to do? Was it?
It was great.
Was it weird?
It was weird. It was weird. I constantly had a feeling of underperforming, not in a way of performance, but on a way of like I am. Very important for me was not to use my experience and that of many of my friends for my own gain. And in that moment, there were so many movies. Welcome to Sarajevo. Christmas in Sarajevo. What Christmas, man? You know, it's just like everybody's using Sarajevo left and right. And I didn't even want to use it in my songs. Didn't even want to use it in my theater play. If anybody should use it for the game, people of Sarajevo should use it for the game, not people over here, right? I felt it would be a betrayal of my friends.
When Behind God's Back wrapped up, Gino stayed in Seattle, he got a permanent green card, and he kept creating. In 1996, Gino formed Culture Shock. The band's still going strong with a devoted following in Europe. And then at some point, Gino found himself in a new kind of creative project as well. He writes plays, and he helps a specific population put on their own shows, people with developmental disabilities. Right now, they're working on A Midsummer Night's Dream.
It's time for me to do something for somebody else.
Do you get a different kind of gratification from that? Like, do you get a different satisfaction from that type of work than you did when you were center stage?
Yeah. I like supporting people in their achievements. I love it. I think that's what I was missing in my life. I'm finding it right now. Because it's beautiful when you see somebody achieve something, and you know that you support that. It's not about you. Art therapy and whatever, however we call it, is something that just crowned my life.
Gino Yevgevic, playwright, counselor to special needs adults, and lead singer of Culture Shock. To see a video of the band's new song, Tie You, head over to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. That's it for this edition of Sound Effect. Our show is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Ali Ferguson, Shane Mailing, and Arwin Nix. Max Wasserman is our intern, and our executive producer is Matt Martinez. Music from Blue Dot Sessions. We have a really special show coming up for you next week. KNKX will be opening our brand new building in Tacoma's Theater District, and we'll be hosting a live 2-hour version of Sound Effect, showcasing stories from the South Sound. The whole thing is open to the public, and you can learn more at knkx.org. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. You can find it all over the place, including NPR One, Spotify, or your smart speaker. And please also consider rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, or send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.